The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
From my personal memories of the 80s, Eustace Street and Temple Bar were the background to everything. So I said I'll make that the background to the painting.
An artist's impression of Dublin in the 1980s from artist Una Seely. Also...
These women really wanted to represent themselves as active participants in the family. They very much shape how they represent themselves by using their pen.
The Daughters of the First Earl of Cork, a new book which illuminates life in the 17th century for women in a prominent family. Plus, Dublin dealer Ian Dowling will join me in studio to talk about some of the historical treasures in his collection. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. But to begin this evening, as you know, a lot has changed in the past week as the coronavirus has brought many large public gatherings to a halt, and our own Hindsight Festival in Kells, which was planned for next weekend, is no exception, as we've had to call it off in the interests of public health. Keep an eye, though, on hinterland.ie, where we're going to be hosting a curtailed virtual festival with some of the talks and other related material. But we're going to bring you now one of the stories that we planned to cover at that festival next weekend. This story is from the height of the War of Independence. It involves the IRA, an alleged informer, and an execution, which illustrates the kind of local conflicts that took place between the IRA and ordinary citizens. We came across it in the military archives at Cathal Brua Barracks in Dublin, amongst the brigade activity reports associated with the military services pension collection, a valuable resource which, of course, we've drawn from many times before during this decade of centenaries on this programme. I'm joined by Dr. Liam McNiff, an historian and author who has been researching this episode. Liam, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Now, the central figure in this story is a man named John Harrison, although he appears in the brigade activity reports as John Harris. Who was he? Why was he targeted by the IRA?
John Harrison was 54-year-old Methodist farmer from Drumreilly, townland a few miles outside Ballinamore in Leitrim. The cold facts are that he was actually taken out by the local IRA. They had the idea that he was an informer or a spy, and he was shot. But like most things, there's background to it. The IRA had imposed an arms levy on farmers the previous October. Harrison had about 40 acres. He was levied £1.
And this was to be used to buy weapons,
yeah,
and
fund the war, I suppose. And he refused to pay it. So then they went to take one of his best cows, and he was armed and he shot. But they managed to take the cow. Now, it's unclear exactly how it was sorted. It may have been the intervention of a Protestant clergyman, but he paid the pound. He got his cow back. Now, that was in October and things seemed to settle down. But by the following April, his mail was intercepted. Two things. One account says it was the railway. Frequently, the local IRA interrupted the railway and got the mail. Mm. Or it could be his daughter was going to town. But in any event...
Right. OK, we have that aspect or that element of the story. We're going to hear from the military archives. And in the Leitrim Brigade Activity Report, the local battalion commandant, Sean O'Farrell, describes how Harrison, who, as I say, he mistakenly calls Harris, was exposed, at least according to this account, as an informer.
He was under suspicion for some time previously, and a girl was suspected of carrying dispatches for him to the Crown Forces at Ballinamore. The girl was searched one evening as she was going into Ballinamore, and in her bag was discovered an unaddressed letter. When questioned, she stated that the letter was for a man named Davidson, the postmaster in Ballinamore. When the letter was read, it contained a report from Harris to the police, and contained the names of members of the local company whom he stated raided his house some time previously. He was taken out that night and executed.
And we'll have more details on that from another entry into that brigade activity report. The words there of Sean O'Farrell, a local battalion commandant. The girl in question isn't named, but we can assume it was Harrison's daughter.
Yeah, we're not sure actually. Harrison, he actually had 12 children ranging from 6 months to 15 years. And they were all in the house when they came. And to protect them, He gave himself up, basically.
Now, it's important to say that accounts in the military archives, they're extremely valuable. They're gold dust. Yeah. But they can't always be taken as gospel. And any good historian will cross-reference them with other sources. So what did you find out about Harris's identification as an informer? What kind of detail can you give us on that?
Interesting. Again, when you read the different accounts, you get different angles on it. His wife claimed till her death in 1935, talking to friends locally, that her husband was totally innocent, that he'd done absolutely nothing wrong. The IRA accounts, brigade accounts and so on say that he gave information. Now, unlike Latimer, who was another Protestant killed a few weeks previously, Latimer, that other man, was supposed to have given information that allowed the Black and Tans military to ambush six IRA and kill them. In our case with Harrison, there was no actual, we never got proof. I'm not saying he wasn't a spy or informer or that he was, but nobody ever got proof of what he was supposed to have given. The nearest we got is what you got in that excerpt where it said he told the name of the people who raided his farm for his cow.
So, in other words, he identified to the RIC.
See, that's what
a number
was,
of yes. local RI, IRA.
Now, there was
men.
A sign put around his neck, you know, the usual, spy
and
informer, beware.
I mean, you have to assume also that the local RIC, this wouldn't have been particularly news to the local RIC. They would have known exactly who the local
would.
IRA
they
men.
They would, exactly.
Okay, let's hear another extract from that Leitrim Brigade Activity Report. This is for the 22nd of April, 1921. And here the company captain, Thomas Smith, takes up the story of the killing of John Harrison.
We took different positions around the house, except three men who were left on sentry about 200 yards away on the roadway. We demanded admittance in the name of the IRA, and he was so long and making so much noise, we got suspicious of his movements. We kept banging at both doorways, when next a shot rang out, and again two or three more. So I gave the order, each man two rounds. We smashed the windows. I gave a second order, each man two rounds more, so that we would frighten him. But he replied with about five rounds rapid. So we understood he was either armed with a rifle or a revolver. Each man reloaded with the third order, two more rounds. We had everything broken then. I called out to surrender, or we would blow up his house. He surrendered, having put a short service rifle on the window and about 20 rounds of ammunition.
Now, Liam, that's from the company captain, Thomas Smith, from that Leitrim Brigade Activity Report. I remember when I read that, I made the assumption that he was in the house of his own, and then I realised, hang on, I checked the 1911 census and realised that there were children. He was not in the house on his own.
And in fact, when you read the different accounts, I went through all the newspapers, North and South, referring to it. And like the Northern ones, something like the Belfast Newsletter, would highlight the fact that he, like his head was blown away. And they would highlight something like that, the brutality of it. Whereas other papers would give a more neutral stance on it. But he was in a house with 12 children and his wife. And in fact, she was up nursing two sick children. And they were told to stay in the house for an hour, and his 16-year-old son found him. And what's interesting, they walked him right, because a local man helped me find the actual area, they walked him just out of his town land to shoot him.
Why was that?
I don't know whether it was respect that he wanted to kill him on his own land, but they just walked him across a little bridge which was dividing one town land from another, and just across it, and then shot him.
And presumably the reason why he gave himself up was because when they threatened to bomb the house or burn the house, he realised that his children, there was a chance that his children and his wife would die as
and
well.
And the other thing is, as far as I can gather, I'm not positive, but it was a thatched house. And I mean, if they had set fire or anything, but there definitely was a gun battle.
It would have gone up very quickly. Yeah. Let's hear another extract from the Brigade Activity Report. Again, this is the company captain, Thomas Smith, continuing the story of the execution of John Harrison.
I asked him to open the door, and he did so. John Maguire and Paddy Martin got in the back window at the same time. He begged us not to shoot him. I said we had to carry out our orders. We told him he had to come with us. We also told him he needed no coat. So, we brought him about 300 yards down towards the bog. I asked him was there any reason why he shouldn't be executed, as he was both spying and informing. He never made an answer. The three men who fired the shots were volunteer Patrick Martin, volunteer James McTighe, and volunteer John Maguire. I myself, as captain, placed a label with cord around his neck. Shot as spy and informer. Beware.
The level of detail there is very interesting, because you don't often in any of these reports have the men who were actually responsible, who were in the firing squad, and there normally were about three IRA men in each of these firing squads, identified. Part of the reason for that is because this is to assist people in assigning pensions subsequently to IRA men, and obviously it enhances your pension application if you were involved in a firing squad.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to keep that in mind, because there were people interviewed by local historians and local county library and things years later, and they gave a somewhat different account and unofficially would point the finger at a different person pulling the trigger. So it's interesting. I nearly feel if you were kind of given the evidence years later in the cold light of no crisis, you might be minimising that you had pulled the trigger. Whereas if you're given it at the time looking for a pension, you're going to be maximising it.
Hmm. What was the local reaction to Harrison's death?
The shock. Now, it wasn't. In fact, there was a Frank Darcy interviewed years later. He would have been about 12 at the time. But he was interviewed years later. And he said it was, you know, they were total shock. People, he was regarded as an inoffensive farmer. Now, on the other hand, Darcy did say, look, if you were given information, maybe that caused other people's deaths. Hmm. But the fact, if you like, that unlike the Latimer man, who was accused of giving the information that caused six IRA to be killed 4 weeks earlier.
That was at what,
Selton Hill, exactly. Selton Hill, you know, yeah. And there were six people killed, IRA killed, and he was responsible, and that was it. This man, if you like, they had no hard, there was no obvious evidence. But remember, it's in that time when six IRA have been killed, three big Republican funerals in Ballinamore, the Tans have burned down the local hall and a hall in Aughwillan. Like, there's a boycott on Catholic and Protestant traders who are continuing to keep the shops open when the local IRA wanted a boycott to close it to put pressure on England about how prisoners, IRA prisoners, were being treated. So no more than now, all the norms are gone out.
And it's also 1921, the first half of 1921, when paranoia reigned amongst the IRA, because the British were beginning to make intelligence inroads as well. Is there any indication that Harrison was targeted specifically because he was a Protestant?
I don't think so. But if you put, I mean, common sense would dictate that Protestants, by their nature, would not have been happy with the struggle for independence. Their sympathy would have been with England. And also, I mean, the fact that Harrison didn't want to give the levy of £1 put him on the wrong side. Now, the other point is there were Catholics who were, if anyone got in the place of the IRA, there was a McCabe man, Catholic, who was joining the RIC, was warned twice not to, decided he'd still join. On his way to the railway in Ballinamore to get to Dublin to the depot, he was shot, and his leg so badly shot it had to be amputated. Now, years later, he got £3,000 or something, which was a massive money at that time. But he was a Catholic. There was a rate collector in in Carrigallenshot. Again, no mention of he being Protestant. And there was a big notice up to boycott certain shops. Now, they tended to be Protestant, but there were Catholic shops in it. So my impression is, if you got in the way of the IRA, it didn't matter if you're Catholic, Protestant, but you're more likely to be suspect if you were Protestant.
But what was the perception of the reason for targeting Harrison? Because there was an exodus of Protestants from that part of Leitrim, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, overall, nationally, the exodus between 1911 and 1926 was about 30%. Leitrim had something like that overall, whereas the exodus of Catholics would only have been 10%, you know, emigration. Mm. But the Methodist in the Ballinamore circuit, which was a Methodist division, probably covered, there about four or five different circuits in Leitrim. But in the Methodist circuit of Ballinamore, which from 1912 to 26, the number of Methodists went down from 151 to 51, a 67% decrease. And actually that town land where Harrison was killed had 28 Protestants, I think it was, and 14 Catholics or something roughly like that. And now there's just one Protestant family. Now, there can be lots of different reasons.
You have discovered involvement of members of your own family or of a member of your own family in a killing,
yeah.
which is, I suppose, not altogether different from this.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about
that. In fact, this Liam Kelly, who'd be a first cousin of mine, he was ordained a priest in 1978. And in December of that year, he got a phone call out of the blue from somebody in St. Davenant's, the psychiatric hospital in Monaghan, to say that a relative of his had died and would he come and make arrangements. The relative was a Michael Kelly, who'd be a first cousin of my mother and of Liam Kelly's mother, and he had just died in the hospital. We had never heard of him. Now, we had a whole lot of relatives, but in Ireland, you know most of your relatives. My mother, as a child, when she was living with an aunt for a few years, heard a reference to this man, but he was completely airbrushed. And why? This man, a Michael Kelly, had joined the local IRA in West Cavan as an 18-year-old. And his first assignment, like going to Harrison, was to get arms from a local Protestant clergyman in Bonboy, only a few miles from where Harrison.
This is Finlay.
Yeah, and this happened 7 weeks after Harrison, we're talking about, was killed. So he went with the other IRA to the house and some confrontation happened. He was part of it and the Protestant minister was killed. Now, about 3 or 4 weeks later, my mother's first cousin was found wandering in a state of mental, he had a breakdown. In the Midlands. And as usual, you were sent to the lunatic asylum. He was incarcerated in Monaghan. And that was 1921. We never heard of him until 1978. He had spent 57 years there.
And died there.
And died there. And completely airbrushed. And like my cousin, he said, like, I was a few miles up the road. He says, I'd have gone to visit him.
Hmm.
But what makes me really aware of this is that, like, the War of Independence isn't something that kind of happened out there. This is the reality of when people, you know, in a crisis, do something. And then I'm sure we'll hear cases in a while of people now will look back and say, oh, my God, why did I do that during a crisis?
Hmm. Liam McNiff, thank you very much indeed for joining us and bringing us the story of the killing of John Harrison and other activities in County Leitrim during the War of Independence. Would have been a much longer talk, a more extensive talk at the Hindside Festival in Kells, and will be going online in the days ahead in our virtual Hindside Festival online on www.hinterland.ie. Liam, thanks once again for that. Now, in our occasional series, Here's the Thing, reporter Julian Clancy uncovers the stories behind objects on display in the Little Museum of Dublin. Today, he's taking us back to Dublin in the 1980s and focusing on a piece of art that reflects life in the capital during that decade.
Una Seely is a Dublin-based artist who fondly remembers the 80s in Dublin.
Everybody lived in really grotty flats, you know, where you just have a room with the phone down in the hall, and you didn't have to pay for any of your phone calls because you just tapped the number. You're too young to know about tapping.
Tapping was some kind of crazy oversight on public phones in Ireland, where you could actually tap out a number by pressing the receiver button and make free calls. It's how an entire generation stayed in contact with their friends.
Because back in those days, like, it would cost you sort of 60 quid to talk to America, if you had a friend in America, to talk for 20 minutes. So there were ways around these things. And if there's a way, a Dubliner will find it.
Una was one of 10 artists who were asked to create a piece of art for the Little Museum of Dublin that would capture a decade. Having lived as an artist in the city centre from around 1982, Una was given the 80s.
Those 10 years was when I was finding my feet as an artist, trying to get by in one of the most difficult decades, you know, that I can remember.
Now, before we describe the painting, you first have to know a little bit more about what it was like to live in the 80s in Dublin.
It was scruffy, it was anarchic, it was broke, everybody was on the dole. You know, there was loads of like shebeens, you know, illegal late night drinking places. It was very grim, but it was also really good fun.
The 80s in Dublin and Ireland were also a bad time to be an artist too.
I think there was 12 artists in Ireland who were actually making a living out of their art.
At the same time, the one saving grace was the cheap rents. Most of the buildings in the city centre were earmarked for demolition, including at one stage the whole of Temple Bar. CIE were actually going to replace all of it with a brand new bus depot.
Can you imagine? I mean, that was Ireland at the time, though, wasn't it? Like, you know, they were busy knocking down everything.
But while these buildings awaited demolition, the artists moved in for next to nothing rents. Una herself moved into a studio on Eustace Street in the heart of Temple Bar. And this is where she got her inspiration for her painting for the Little Museum of Dublin.
From my personal memories of the 80s, Eustace Street and Temple Bar were the background to everything. So I said, I'll make that the background to the painting.
Una's painting is a collage of images that are mostly music related. You can spot the iconic image of the cover of the Boy album from U2. That's in there because the band went to the same school as Una. But there's also other Dublin bands in there that you might not have heard of.
I've shown the cover of a band called The Atrix. Their best known single was called Treasure in the Wasteland. You just got this image of derelict sites with buddleia growing all over them, and within that, this burgeoning arts, music and theatre scene. So there was real treasure in the wasteland that was Dublin.
Another recognisable face is the bottom corner of Una's painting is that of Tom McGinty, or the Dice Man. Tom was a street artist, originally from Scotland, and he used to appear on the streets of Dublin dressed as the Mona Lisa or Dracula, a teapot or even a clown.
I remember when he first appeared on Grafton Street and people thought, oh, that's weird, and throw things at him. But he became really accepted, loved and lauded in Dublin. So I just felt that, you know, that was very much such a kind of iconic, you know, figure of Dublin in the 80s.
By the end of the 80s, nearly 30% of all college graduates in Ireland emigrated.
I've shown an old style Aer Lingus airplane because so many of my friends, colleagues and contemporaries left Ireland in the 80s.
For those who remained at home, there was little opportunity. You were weighed down by the double burden of a state unable to invest in its people and a church that also had way too much control over them. For Una, this is where In Dublin magazine became the voice box of a generation.
In Dublin, it addressed all the issues of the time, you know, sexuality, contraception, abortion, divorce, things that were really affecting our lives and that we were, you know, we were being told what to do about. And In Dublin was on our side, you know, young people's side.
Una's painting of Dublin is a very evocative and powerful collection of icons from a different Dublin than the one that we might recognise now. But the painting's more than that too, because as part of the Little Museum of Dublin's art collection, reflecting a different decade of history, Una's painting is history through the eyes of an artist.
I think artists can bring history to life because they are interpreting past events in a contemporary way. And it means a huge amount to me that I have a piece in this collection. And I'm very proud of that.
And Julian Clancy was reporting there, talking to Una Seely, who gave an artist's impression of Dublin in the 1980s. Here's the Thing is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. After the break, we'll be heading back to Ireland in the 17th century as Anne Maria Walsh will join me to talk about her new book, The Daughters of the First Earl of Cork.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. We're going back now to the 17th century and opening up a collection of letters and writings that illuminate the lives of women in a prominent family. I'm joined now by Anne Maria Walsh of the School of English at University College in Dublin. She's the author of a new book called The Daughters of the First Earl of Cork, Writing, Family, Faith, Politics and Place. Anne Maria, you're very welcome indeed.
Thank you, Miles.
Now, this is about the daughters of the first Earl, sometimes known as the Great Earl, Richard Boyle, a very, very important figure in early modern Ireland, perhaps the most successful of the new English planters who arrived here in the late 16th century and who dominated Irish politics, I suppose, and certainly the politics of that part of the country of Munster. Talk to me a bit about how you came to write about the women in what is probably one of the most famous families in Irish history.
Well, Miles, I first of all came across the women in 2012 when I went to visit St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I saw the Boyle Monument, which is an absolutely enormous funerary effigy. As you go in the door of the cathedral, it's immediately to your left, so it's the first thing that you see. And the monument stands 32 feet high. It's comprised of four tiers with 16 individually carved statues.
Subtle it is not.
Not at all, yeah. So what struck me about the monument, besides its size, was the line of six daughters kneeling at eye level as you look at the monument. And the daughters looked to me like as if they were propping up the monument. And I was really intrigued about them because obviously the monument was signifying the importance of this family, but I had never heard about the daughters. And I decided to investigate. And what I did discover is that they had left behind a magnificent treasure trove of writings. And those writings include letters, a diary, an autobiography, a memorandum book, pious meditations, a prose treatise, and accounts books and medical receipt books.
I'll ask you an historian's question. Are these all conveniently located in one archive or are they scattered all over the place?
They're scattered. They're scattered between Ireland, England and Scotland mainly. And in that respect, it reflects the geopolitical importance of the Boyle family as well. Now, what's interesting from the women's point of view is, first of all, majority of these letters aren't listed anywhere. Because they were women, you have to go and physically sift through boxes and boxes of material to find the letters. But also, many of these women's letters weren't preserved at all. They were preserved if the letters were written addressed to senior men in the family or important men outside of the family. So what we have today is, you know, a tiny drop in the ocean in comparison to what these women actually wrote at the time.
Now, some of the material that you have in the book is not actually from the daughters of Richard Boyle. In one instance, it's from the daughter-in-law, Elizabeth Clifford, who married his heir, the second Earl, also called Richard.
Tell us
a little bit about her memorandum book and why is it useful as an historical source? What does it tell us about the lives of women during that period?
Okay, well, this memorandum book is held in Chatsworth House in Derbyshire. Elizabeth Clifford was the daughter of the 5th Earl of Cumberland, and she was a very wealthy heiress in her own right. She married Richard Boyle, Viscount Dungarvan, in 1634. And the memorandum book is a real treasure trove because she starts writing this book in 1659. And she continues for 30 years. So it offers a very rare and sustained insight into the life of an heiress. And what's revealing, I suppose, from an Irish perspective is the way in which she enacts her role as a Boyle matriarch. And that includes, for example, first of all, documenting all births, marriages and deaths that occurred in the family. She records for her own children, for example, exactly where they were born, who were the godparents, what were the circumstances, the name of the child, etc. And what's interesting about that is it shows that her own children were born in Ireland and in England as well. She also, post the Restoration, documents a trip that the entire family undertook from London in 1662, down through England, through Wales, across the Irish Sea, landing on the Great Island, known today as Cove, and then journeying from Cove to Youghal. And she tracks the time they spent in Ireland during that particular period, you know, which ties in with the seasons as well. You know, so many months in Youghal, summer in Lismore, travelling to Dublin for the winter and tracking that journey back again. And what's interesting is that her eldest son had married and the daughter-in-law was part of the family group. and the daughter-in-law had her second child in Dublin during the visit as well. And it's the book and the record of it is all about replicating that history and passing on that kind of bifurcated existence that the Boyles lived, making sure that they kept a visible presence on the land. And, you know, by the fact that children were to be born in both locations as well, really perpetuated that kind of style of living as well.
How did they fare during the Cromwellian period and during the English Civil War and then obviously Cromwell's side visit to Ireland?
Well, what's interesting, particularly about the second Countess of Cork, is that she played a really important role for the family during the Cromwellian period, because she spent quite a bit of time in Youghal, and she maintained the family's presence there as their representative while the men in the family were away fighting and eventually had to go into exile and stay in exile in the continent. And we know that she spent time in Youghal because she signed land leases during that time. So, you know, the women in the family...
So she kept the family business going.
She kept it going, and she made sure that she represented the family's interests. And apparently Cromwell wintered in Youghal whilst the second Countess of Cork was there as well. And there are also letters, there's actually a letter in the National Library dated 1648 in which she writes to Lord Inchiquin complaining about the fact that the soldiers were being billeted in her home in Youghal, and she wanted to, you know, move them on, so to speak.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
And did the members of the family, because we're talking about 12 children who survived, I think all of the female members married. The only one who remained unmarried was the youngest, was the scientist, Robert Boyle. Did they remain loyal to one side or the other, or did they swap around?
The Boyles typically were very pragmatic, and you know, once they could see that Cromwell was in charge, etc., the women particularly used their pens to write to Cromwell and to make representations to him on behalf of the family as well. So the Boyles were well able to weave their way around these challenges. One of the women...
But presumably they were happier with the restoration then.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they were... Ultimately, they were royalists, but they always prioritised the family's interests above everything else.
Now, the number of them are absolutely fascinating, but one letter that you write about in the book is from October 1623, from Richard Boyle's second daughter, Sarah. Sarah
That's right.
was born in 1609,
yeah.
Didn't have a very long life, and maybe you'll explain why she didn't have a particularly long life. But she's writing to her father after arriving at her new home of in Mellifont in County Louth, and she's writing about her new husband.
That's right. This letter was written by Sarah late in October 1623, and ostensibly the letter is just writing to her father to confirm that she arrived safely in her new destination, which was her marital home of Mellifont Abbey, County Louth. And what happened was Sarah originally married Sir Thomas Moore, who was the son of Gareth Moore, Viscount of Drogheda. She married him on the 9th of July 1621 when she was 12 years of age. And Sarah was allowed to remain in the family home, the Boyle home, for another couple of years whilst Thomas Moore went off on his grand tour of the continent to finish his education. He returned in 1623, came to collect Sarah.
Had they met at this stage? Was that the first time they met?
No, they met, obviously
at the wedding,
right. But that was 2 years prior. Mm-hmm. And Sarah then was escorted. She travelled by horse from Lismore to Mellifont, arriving sometime the end of October. And the Earl of Cork received a letter on the 1st of December announcing that Thomas Moore had died of smallpox. So Sarah literally had about a month of married life with Thomas Moore.
And was exposed to smallpox herself.
In the meantime, absolutely. She was returned to Cork in February 1624, back to her natal family again, but married for a second time in 1626.
Robert Digby.
That's right. She had three children with Robert Digby of Gishill, County Offaly. And then in July 1623, she herself died as a result of childbirth. So really you could say that Sarah's letter, you know, it kind of opens up a life in which she, at a very young age, you know, was married twice, was widowed and died in childbirth, which was common enough at that time as
even
well.
Even with the aristocracy, obviously it would have been common with the hoi polloi, very common with the hoi polloi.
Absolutely.
Even the aristocracy?
Yes. Apparently one in four women died during the first 10 years of marriage and during the childbearing years as well. So it was very common. And in fact, in 1623, when Sarah died of childbirth, three of her other sisters were also pregnant at that time.
Now, one of the women you write about, a tough character, the eldest child, eldest daughter and eldest child, Alice, who becomes Countess Barrymore. Yes. She writes a letter to an MP in London. And the interesting thing about the letter is that the castle that she was writing it from was under siege at the time. So tell me a little bit about her and that was all about.
Well, Alice was a formidable character and her personality really, really shines through in her letters. But on this particular occasion, she's writing on the 16th of March, 1640. From Castle Lines, and she basically says that she's living in terror and fear every day, that she's surrounded by the papists, she's suffering cruelty from the papists, and she's writing to Sir Ralph Verney asking him, as a grave Parliament man, to send more aid to save the Munster Protestants.
So this is at the time of the 1641 rebellion?
The height of the 1641 rebellion at this time. And what's interesting about Alice and her particular family is that she was married to David Barry, and he had many relatives who were Catholics. So a lot of the people that were besieging the castle, you know, were very likely relatives of her husband as well. What's interesting about the castle is she says that she can't leave because so many depend upon her for their safety. And castles such as Castle Lines provided, you know, a sanctuary for the surrounding Munster Protestants who made their way to the castle, brought their livestock and families and took shelter there as well. So that's why she's kind of representing herself as an advocate for the Munster Protestants in that way.
Well, an obvious question, how did the letter get out? I mean, there wouldn't have been any postal service in those days and the castle was surrounded.
It was a huge risk, and she says that a cousin of hers was being sneaked out of the castle. So she passed the letter to him, and she was risking a lot by actually writing, because the letter could have been intercepted at the time. But what's also interesting about the way she writes is she doesn't mention names, and she says, you know, I can't give you any particulars. So she's very careful. She's imposing kind of self-censorship in regard to the information in the letter, but she's giving enough hints to let Sir Ralph Verney know that they're in dire straits.
How educated were these women? Obviously they were literate, but you know, they couldn't write letters otherwise. But how educated would they have been? Would they have been allowed to have been?
Well, Richard Boyle was a staunch Protestant, and the influence of the Protestant Reformation meant that fathers like Richard Boyle wanted their children, boys and girls, to be able to read and write so that they could read the Bible and engage with it and, you know, maintain sermon notes, etc. So there was a big investment in education in the Boyle household. The girls were taught to read and write. They also learned French. They were taught needlework and dancing and how to make polite conversation. And most importantly of all, run a large household and landed estate as well. And you can see from their letters that they have huge experiential knowledge of running these estates, mainly on their own while the men were away for months at a time. And you can also see their kind of insight and knowledge in terms of the legalities and financials of running those estates as well. The letters are very revealing in that respect.
They're tenacious women. I mean, they're not shrinking violets, are they?
Not at all, not at all. I suppose the really consistent, there's two very consistent aspects about these women that you notice reading their letters. The first one is the things that really mattered to these women remained so over the trajectory of their lives. And those things were money, land, faith and succession. And they were all intertwined. The other consistent feature is that these women really wanted to represent themselves as doers, as active participants in the family, as important contributors to the success of the family and to their local communities and to the aristocracy in Ireland and Britain as well. And their letters really show how these women were aware of their audience who was reading their letters, and they very much shape how they represent themselves by using their pen in a very careful way.
Well, the book is The Daughters of the First Earl of Cork, Writing, Family, Faith, Politics and Place. It's published by Four Courts Press. The author is Anne Maria Walsh. Many thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Miles.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
And welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Now, Irish Pickers is a new TV series that follows the Dublin antiques dealer and history enthusiast Ian Dowling as he hunts down and buys collectibles that tell stories of our country's past. It premieres on Blaze TV, that's on Sky Channel 164, at 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. this Thursday, the 19th of March. And Ian joins me now in studio. He's brought along some historical treasures from his own collection into the studio to show us today. You're very, very welcome to the History Show.
Thanks for having me, Moz.
And a pat on the back for the programme. I was sent a link to the programme on Vimeo, and I said I will discharge my obligation to my employer. I'll watch about 10 or 15 minutes and I'll probably doze off because I have no interest in antiques or collectibles. And after 10 or 15 minutes, sure, I'll watch a bit more. And then after, and I'll watch a bit more, and I found myself watching the whole thing. It's really, really good. It's beautifully shot. It looks really, really good. And the ensemble cast, very, very engaging. So congratulations. I mean, I want to watch the whole series now.
Thank you. That's good to hear. Thanks so much, Miles.
Okay, so you've brought in one pretty extraordinary and pretty macabre piece, which I'm looking at, and I'm getting the willies looking at it, because it's Kevin Barry's death mask. That is his actual death mask. Tell me about how you acquired that.
I bought this in an auction a couple of years ago, and couldn't quite believe my luck, really. I know it's quite a unique piece. I mean, like you say, it's quite a dark piece, but it's also a very important piece of Irish history. Kevin Barry was the youngest person ever to be executed on the island, and his death actually was one of the kind of pivotal moments, really, during the War of Independence, and not long after, people started looking towards the negotiations and the next step, I guess, was the treaty. So it was kind of, you know, I just couldn't believe it when I came across this. I mean, and yeah, I snapped it up. I think I paid about $3,000 for it.
Mm. And just tell me, this was in an auction in Kilkenny, and there was other Kevin Barry memorabilia which were being sold there. And I mean, they fetched astronomical prices, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's very little kind of original memorabilia that has come onto the market, except for the letter, his last letter to his his pals in UCD, just before he was executed. So you can imagine this is the centenary year of his death. 100 years ago, Halloween night, he was sitting in a damp cell writing a letter to his pals before he met his maker the following morning. And that letter achieved about, I think it was 87,000.
That's something you actually would, you're never going to sell it. You're not going to sell
Never going to sell it. No, never going to sell it.
But you were saying to me at some point you may give it to a museum.
I'd like to give it to a museum at some point. Yeah, I'd like to keep it in the family. But I would never sell it. If I was going to leave the family, we'd go to a museum so other people could enjoy it.
Right, you're never going to make a living here. I'm sorry. behave like that. Spend $3,000 hand it over to a museum.
I know.
I get a sense that items from the War of Independence and the Revolution. Revolutionary periods particularly catch your attention. I presume that's at the moment they are, you know, people who are collectors are more interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's always like a good demand for War of Independence, Easter Rising, particularly Rising. I mean, like there was on the build up to the centenary, you know, there was kind of a lot of excitement and a lot of stuff going through auction rooms, and that's all kind of died down quite a lot ever since 2016. After that auction, then everything kind of calmed down quite a bit. But anytime I get anything from the War of Independence or Rising or anything from that era, it sells really well, and I'm particularly interested in that kind of era myself, so you know, that kind of helps.
And I presume that you have identified people who are collectors, so you buy the stuff, you pay, I mean, this is one of the interesting things for me about the series, you pay a decent price to people who know, as you're buying it from them, that you are going to sell it on for a higher price, that you're out to make a profit from it. But you presumably have identified a number of people who, I know someone who'll be interested in that, so I know how much they will pay, yeah. So I know how much I'm going to pay.
Exactly. Like, I've been 11 years now full-time doing it, and you kind of, after that amount of time, you develop kind of contacts and clients who are interested in different things. And so you can kind of match items up when you're on the road with in your head with people that you that your own clients, people that you know.
Talking about the War of Independence, you brought a grenade. I hasten to add that it has been well disarmed. There's no explosive. Nothing's going to happen. It might.
I'm not going to blow up RT.
Break my ankle if it falls off the desk or something like that. But that's about the height of it. Tell us a little bit. What do you know about that?
It was found in Cork. There was the council actually found it. The army were called. It was deactivated, made safe, and then I got a call about it and asked, would I be interested? And I said, yeah. Now, a very unique piece. I mean, it's not something I've ever seen in Ireland, but I just had to snap it up, and
it's very heavy.
It is, isn't it?
Extraordinarily heavy. I mean, I cannot imagine. You'd need to have a good arm to be able to throw that any distance.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, just an interesting.
And you also had, I'm not sure if you brought it with you, but I think you have a pike head from the 1798 rebellion.
Yeah, that was in the Wexford episode. We met a dealer who had a local farmer had gotten in touch with him, and he had found it on his land when he was doing some work, and he sold it to that dealer, and I bought it from the dealer. So it would have been used most likely by the United Irishmen during the 1798 rebellion. It's the pike head, so it would have been on top of a kind of like sitting on top of a long pole or stick, you know, and that was the kind of weapon of choice used by peasants in that rebellion.
Now, you also have these, they're called clocking boards. So they're very small. You've got about, half a dozen of them, five of them here, in actual fact, I have in my hand. And they have numbers. They're just a few centimetres, rectangular pieces of wood with numbers on them. Explain what those are.
So I got them up in Belfast, in the Belfast episode. We went to a dealer who specialised in kind of Titanic memorabilia, Harland and Wolff memorabilia. So these are clocking boards used by Harland and Wolff staff. So they were kind of used, they had this system, Harland and Wolff had this system from about 1860 to about 1970. And really, when you arrived to Harland and Wolff for your day's work, you were given one of these boards, as they were called. And as you can see, like, there's a six-digit piece of wood with a six-digit number on it. And
so you would slot this in when you clocked in.
That you'd be recorded. So your name and number would be recorded on entry, and you would keep this board with you throughout the day. And when you left, then that's when they calculate your pay. When you went to the toilet, you were recorded time wise with there. And also, if you wanted any tools, you know, like a carpentry tool or whatever it might be, they recorded your number then also. So it was a hugely kind of a very important, you know, piece. And, you know, I guess people who worked on Titanic could have actually used these. You know, so they're a very interesting piece of history, and I got these up in Belfast in that episode.
Which prompts my next question, which is a general question. You've 10 episodes. You tend to concentrate. So the one I saw was in Cork, and made Cork look, I mean, Cork is beautiful, but it made Cork look really, really beautiful, which is great from a tourist perspective. Fáilte Ireland should be buying the series and selling it. But where were the toughest negotiators?
Kerry, I'd say. Kerry.
Well, they don't like dubs down there.
No,
so
they don't like some dub coming down trying to make a few bob out of them. And I guess the publican down in Kerry, James Curran in Dingle, was probably one of my favourites, you know, because I love all that kind of crackling, you know. Some people don't, but I love a kind of tough, you know, tough haggling, tough negotiations.
Because the haggling takes place, not live, but it's obviously recorded, but it is as live. That is real haggling.
It's real, and it's my money, so it's absolutely genuine. So, I mean, every tenner matters to me, you know, and every tenner mattered to James Curran down in Dingle. And, you know, so he was actually a publican and an antique dealer and a Kerry man. So that mix was just lethal.
That is an absolutely lethal mix. Anyway, look, it's a great series. I look forward to seeing the rest of it. The first episode, as I said, airs this Thursday, the 19th of March, on Blaze. So Sky Channel 164. If you don't have Sky, you can stream it on blaze.tv, or you can download the app. Ian's own site is rareirishstuff.com. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Miles.
That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Damien Chanel on sound, and our researcher Liz Gillis. Our readers tonight were Mark Manning and Manus Halligan. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.